All right. Wasn't that beautiful?
Wonderful.
Thank you, band, for that. If you've been tracking with us over the course of the series, you'll know that over the past few weeks, we've laid out a vision for what it means to practice the Christian path here at Nexus. And our hope, my hope, is that these practices have helped us see the Christian path in a brand new light, that the Christian faith is more than a set of beliefs. It's a path. It's a way of life. It's a set of practices. And so this week we come to our final practice, forgiveness. And forgiveness is at the very core of what it means to travel the Christian path. Forgiveness is a quintessential Christian notion and idea, and yet it runs counter, I would say, to almost everything that feels natural to us. It rubs against our fundamental human instincts. And this brings us to the conclusion of the Anasazi riddle that we've been exploring over the course of this series. And if you've been tracking with us the past 6 weeks or so, you'll know that hundreds of years ago in the U.S. Southwest, there was this incredibly sophisticated tribe of people called the Anasazi. And this great tribe of people mysteriously vanished, disappeared in the 13th century, left their homeland suddenly. It was almost like they went out for the afternoon and simply never came home. And in their vanishing, they left for us incredible relics, awe-inspiring cliff dwellings, art and pottery. But archaeological evidence also suggests that they left behind a story filled with violence and brutality. And so today, the mystery, the riddle of the Anasazi endures even now. History is forever left guessing. What exactly happened to these people? Where did they go? Did they truly vanish? Did they end up just killing each other off? I mean, so many questions remain. But what we do know is this, as I try to wrap up the series, and I hope you've enjoyed coming along for this mystery. But what we know is this, the Anasazi did not disappear entirely. In fact, their ancestors still exist today, and it only seems to add another layer to the mystery. Archaeological evidence suggests that, and you see the map here, that during this great crisis period for the Anasazi, some of them migrated north and appeared to die off. Some migrated south and west, and they seem to have amalgamated with other tribes. But then there were others who migrated south and east, further into New Mexico. And today, in that same region, there's about 20,000 people, that's about the size of the town of Fergus, that trace their lineage and culture back to the Anasazi. And they call themselves the Pueblans. And this is where the twist comes in. These remnant descendants of the Anasazi, they detest being referred to as the Anasazi. Because the name is riddled with controversy, as I learned this past summer on my trip to the Southwest. This is a picture of Riley and I in Monument Valley doing our horseback riding thing. And it's interesting that Dave, this is bizarre, Dave sent me the songs that they were doing, and Dust to Dust became like our theme song of this past trip, which might be a little weird, but we thoroughly enjoyed that song together over the trip. But here, Riley and I, on our horses in Monument Valley, and I'll confess right from the beginning, I know that Riley looks the part more than I. I get that. But while he might look the part, I inhabited more of a John Wayne sort of feel than he did. I got on my horse very quickly, but Riley was having a lot of trouble getting on. And so for like 7 times he tried, got his foot in the holster, and he couldn't get up and on the horse. And I'm like, come on, you're ruining the vibe, man. Like, you got to get your stuff together. So he gave himself a heave-ho push, and he went up and over and fell over the other side of the horse. I'm like, you are ruining this. We do not look like cowboys at all here. So there were. My horse was named Blueberry, which, yeah, Blueberry captures sort of the moment there. Finally, we're on our horses. We're deep into Monument Valley, and we're in search of Anasazi rock art. And on our way, our guide has taken us through a dizzying array of bluffs and canyons to find them. Our guide is a native Navajo, and he takes people throughout Monument Valley. And finally, we arrive at this series of petroglyphs. And we are instructed to leave our horses with him and hike the rest of the way on our own. It was weird because our Navajo guide wouldn't approach the Anasazi petroglyphs that you can see here. And at the time, I thought nothing of it. But as I started researching for this series, something jumped out at me. You see, what the term Anasazi means and why it is so contentious is that it's actually a Navajo word. And what the word means is this: ancient enemy. Ancient enemy. For Navajos, Anasazi is accurately descriptive. This is actually where Canada comes into the story. You see, Navajos, Apaches, Comanches, they began migrating down from Canada through the plains to the region where the Anasazi were migrating out of. At the same time the Anasazi were leaving, the Navajos were migrating south. And we know that these two groups had clashes with one another, Chaco Canyon, Mesa Verde, places like that. And so today, the Pueblo people, they don't like being referred to as the Anasazi. They don't like having their identity tied up with enemy, the idea of being an enemy. And yet, all of the archaeological evidence literature out there constantly refers to them that way. And 700 years later, the two groups still exist in tension today. The Navajo, like my guide, won't go near Anasazi ruins, which is why we had to hike the rest of the way on our own. They consider them the realms of the dead, the haunted, lined with goats. As they migrated south, they found these sites littered with corpses, brutality. And so the Anasazi sites are off limits today to the Navajo. Don't go near them. Don't touch them. In fact, the thought is today for the Navajo, do not enter, do not touch an Anasazi site because it means death will leap into your soul. And you can imagine for the Pueblan people who trace their lineage back to the Anasazi, this is offensive. And to this day, they will not allow the Anasazi into their communities or into their sacred ceremonies. In fact, Riley and I stayed with a Navajo man, and around a campfire one night, he told us of a time he tried to attend a Pueblan ceremony, was threatened, asked to leave. You are not welcome in our midst. 700 years later, two groups of people, still tension. And it's all tied up in that word, Anasazi, ancient enemy. You have enemies? Of course you do. Of course you do. We all have enemies, don't we? We don't have a 700-year history of animosity with anyone, but in our short lives, we all pick up enemies. We all pick up wounds and pain and scars and hurt. And some of us might not call a person an enemy overtly, but anyone I think who has been alive long enough realizes that eventually you pick up scars. We have people that we would rather not speak of. That person that we unfriended or unfollowed on Facebook. It's that person that you no longer even give a name to. My ex-wife, that former boyfriend, my ex-boss. Some people have hurt us so deeply we won't even say their names. Or it's that person who, whenever their name does come up, we kind of go off. Oh, you have no idea about them. The person who, when bad things happen to them, you find yourself feeling happy. Person you can't get out of your head. They're taking up real estate in your mind. The person, when you go to sleep at night, you find yourself plotting, rehearsing the things that you wish you could say to them. It's the person you can't even think about without thinking about what they did to you. That person who, in all honesty, we might even wish were dead. And sometimes it's not even hate per se. Sometimes our enemies can be our friends who are doing better than us, leaves us resentful. Sometimes it's our spouse. We never realized how difficult it might be to live with them. Or our parents, who still have unrealistic expectations of us. Might not be our enemy in the strictest sense of the word, but they've hurt us just the same. We're left disappointed, wounded. Sometimes it's even a community, a church, a certain faith tradition. You see, I think this, as we travel through life, we begin to carry with us this extra weight of wounds and scars and the disappointments and betrayals that we've experienced from friends and families and institutions and communities. It weighs us down. It makes walking the Christian path hard when we're weighed down so much. And I would say this, we come eventually to a crossroads. Two paths are eventually presented to us. We have a choice. What path are we going to follow? Human nature and instinct, I think, offer us a path, an old path, an often traveled path. It's the path of resentment and revenge. I would say this is almost built into our DNA. Our most primal instinct, I think, is to lash out at the people who have hurt us, our enemies. And it's fascinating because Scripture names this tendency for us very early, right in Genesis 4. A man named Lamech captures, I think, the path of human nature, the path of woundedness and revenge and how that plays out. And in these two simple lines, I think he manages to capture the essence of revenge. And as you hear him, you can almost hear him mansplaining, right? Like he's just like, ugh. Listen to me here. Lamech said to his wives, Abda and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. If Cain is avenged 77 times, Lamech 77 times. Don't mess with me. I'll avenge myself 77 times. Now, if you happen to be familiar with Jesus teaching on forgiveness, some of these numbers might suddenly jump out to you as a literary alarm clock. Didn't Jesus say we're supposed to forgive 77 times? He's talking about this. But notice what Lamech reveals to us about human nature, about what happens when we're wounded and choose the path of revenge. Lamech is injured, so he kills. He's wounded, so he kills. He pays back 77 times, which is telling. See, revenge, I would say, is this. It's an escalating vortex. It always escalates. You ever have those YouTube moments where you catch yourself, you went to watch a music video, and then after that you started clicking on other videos, and then 2 hours later you're like, good night, that's weird. Started watching a music video, now I'm watching gorillas and clown cars or something. Like, it just go on this total weird path. You get sucked into the vortex of YouTube. I'm so fascinated on YouTube with tornadoes. I love watching tornado videos. They just absolutely fascinate me. Just A, these crazy people who chase them, and B, just the absolute destruction they can cause. And it's interesting to me the way a tornado acts and operates. So often it touches down and then it grows, it escalates. Largest tornado ever recorded in history was in 2013 in Oklahoma. It started out as a funnel, only a few meters wide. It ended up being 2.6 miles wide. I did some Google Map stuff. That's from here up to the university in King. A tornado that size starts like this. It escalates. Revenge is the same way. An initial wound touches down, and before long it becomes this escalating vortex. Always escalates. When others hurt us, it's in our nature to give back the pain we have received to others multiplied. And the problem is there's no end to this. I mean, when is it enough? I received an odd phone call a while back. On the other end of the line was an old friend of mine with a very unusual request for me. You see, I had stood in his wedding party when he and his wife were married 10 years ago. And on the phone, he informed me that he and his wife wanted to retake and recreate all of their wedding photos. And so my friend said to me, Brad, can you come to this shoot and would you be able to find and wear the same suit you originally wore to our wedding? I confess, a wave of anxiety washed over me. That wedding was 10 years ago. I know this is going to surprise some of you, but I am, heftier than I was 10 years ago. So I was terrified getting into that old suit would leave things snug. I was scared I was going to end up actually looking like George Costanza here in his tuxedo, right? Everything a little too snug. And I said to him, are you sure we need to do this? And he said to me, we've got to do this, Brad. I can't take looking at him in my wedding photos. And I knew exactly who the him was. I said, you know what, why don't we get together and talk about this? So we agreed, we ended up sitting in a hot tub together. You see, my friend's wedding party was a man, a very close friend of his, a close friend of the family. And in the years after the wedding, it would come to light that this particular man in the wedding party had been brutally abusing, sexually molesting my friend's younger brother. And when it came to light, there was a lawsuit, a trial, prison time, multiple relational fallouts, ongoing therapy. It had been a painful few years for the family. But even after all of that and trying to move on, my friend said, I see him every time I look at my wedding photos. I want them gone. I need to erase the memory of this man. And you know, my friend and I have talked about this for years. So that night in the hot tub, I asked him something. I said to him, do you think you might ever find forgiveness for this man? And I want to add two caveats to this here. I've known this friend since I was 7 years old. I wouldn't dream about bringing up forgiveness with someone I didn't know that well. And second, even while I was asking that of him, I knew very well, had that been my brother, I wouldn't have even given it a second thought. And yet we're close. We go back a long way. And so I wanted to put the question to him. Would you ever find it in your heart to forgive this man? And predictably, my suggestion, my thought was met with disgust. He said, so help me, Brad, if you dare bring up how he had a troubled childhood, might have been abused himself, if you think I care less about that, you got another thing coming. I said, listen, that's not what I mean by this. I'm not in any way trying to condone what he did. Are you saying that we shouldn't have sued him or pressed charges? No, of course not. There are consequences for things we do. He said, are you telling me I should forget what happened? No, you could never forget what happened. You're saying I should try to reconcile with him? No. That's not what I'm saying. Things could never go back to the way they were. He said, you know, Brad, he never even apologized. In court, of course, he would say that he was sorry, but he never looked at me or my brother in the eye, not once, and said he was sorry. And I said, that's not what I'm talking about either. Forgiveness doesn't hinge on an apology. At this point, my friend was getting worked up. I could sense his anger inside of him in his heart. And he said to me, you know, Brad, if I ever see him, I'll hurt him. I will kill that son of a bitch. And I knew I had pushed too far. But I responded anyway. I said, and would that be enough? Would that end your anger? Would that help your family heal, having him dead? What would be enough? Remember, he looked me in the eye and he said, it will never be enough. And, oh, I get it. But this is always the path of revenge. It's never enough. You can't hurt someone enough to redeem the hurts you've experienced. When we're hurt or wounded, the pain we give back to others, the pain we wish we could give back to others, is never enough. If Cain is avenged 7 times, then Lamech is 77 times. It's a spiraling vortex. And I have seen the path of revenge, and what I'm convinced of is this. Revenge does nothing to heal our broken world. It does nothing to heal our own wounds. All revenge does is keep the pain and violence of our world in circulation. And it doesn't have to be nearly as dramatic as my friend's story. It happens all the time in much more simple ways, but it's all the same. The path of revenge is simply keeping the pain and wounds of violence in circulation. Revenge is basically like putting your bottles on the curb in the recycling bin. You know it's just going to get reused, recycled. It could be as simple as thinking it looks good on someone and something bad happens to them. It's the passive act even of waiting, hoping, I hope something bad happens to that person. It could be as simple as bringing up that mistake that your partner made every time you have a fight with them. I mean, how often do each of us get caught up in keeping scorecards with our friends, our loved ones? Revenge or even just the desire for it does nothing at all to heal our broken world. All it does is keep pain and violence and wounds and hurt in circulation over and over. But then, one Friday, 2,000 years ago, Jesus unjustly hung on a cross. He reveals to us and opens up to us a new path. On that Friday, as N.T. Wright would say, the revolution began. Because in the midst of his pains and wounds on the cross, he cries out, "Father, forgive them." They have no idea what they're doing. And I can't imagine ever getting a place to say that with the people who have wounded me, hurt me. They have no idea what they're doing. So often our thoughts are exactly, they knew exactly what they were doing. And then later, Jesus dies with these words, "It is finished." What is finished? Oh, the story of the cross is about the end of violence. What Jesus is saying is that the path of revenge can now stop here. It's finished with him. It is done. And what Jesus was doing was taking the pain and violence out of circulation. Instead of returning it multiplied, he bears it and reveals to us the liberating choice of traveling the path of forgiveness instead of revenge. And here's the thing. At Nexus, we're committed to that practice. No matter how painful, no matter how long it takes, no matter how hard it seems, no matter what that person or church or community did to you, we're committed to traveling the path of forgiveness. We're going to ask you to return to it and travel it again and again and again. Consider what John the Baptist says of Jesus. He says he's the Lamb that takes away the sin of the world. What does that mean? Take away the sin of the world. How does that work? Is it some sort of like spiritual magic trick? No. In this case, this is something more than a metaphor going on here. And looking at Jesus' death, we realize this. Jesus takes the worst of the worst the world has to offer, torture, pain, injustice, wounds. He holds it, transforms it, gives back love. He takes in bitterness and violence and cruelty. He holds it in himself, transforms it inside of himself, and gives back grace. He takes in curses and injustices and anger and frustration. He holds it, transforms it, gives back blessing. The abuse, the murder, the torture, holds it, transforms it, gives back forgiveness. He takes in all the darkness and ugliness of our world and hands back beauty. This is the path of forgiveness. Jesus takes away the sin of the world. And his invitation to us is this. You and I, we can do the same thing. We can take in the wounds that people give us, hold it, transform it, give back love, grace, beauty. And when we do that, we participate with Christ in saving the world. This is what it means to practice the Christian faith. In fact, in the prayer that Jesus taught his disciples, our own forgiveness in some way seems to hinge on extending it to others. We see this in the Lord's Prayer. I want to talk a little bit about this. I'm wondering, though, if you'll recite this with me now. It's sort of the heart of the Christian prayer life is the Lord's Prayer. I'm wondering if you'll recite this with me this morning. Our God in heaven, hallowed be your name. Your kingdom come, your will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For yours is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. Notice something here, though. It almost appears if we want to be forgiven, we must forgive. Really? What does that mean? What I would say is this. What Jesus is doing here is inviting us into a relational flow. It's a rhythm. It's not a formula. It's not a requirement. A rhythm. What do I mean by that? What I'd say is this. When you start following the path of Christ, you find yourself in this flow of passing along what has been given to you. It becomes a natural flow that you extend to others. How does this work? To be honest, the only way I can really describe this is through hot yoga. This is going to be weird because it's going to do a hot yoga exercise here. How many of you have done hot yoga? Right. I'm horrible at hot yoga. I can't even, you know, I'm the guy who's always falling over. And it's horrible. Kristen's like, I can't even go with you. You're just so embarrassing in there. You can't hold a pose for like more than 5 seconds. But the one area that I excel at, and my teacher even said I did, but one area I excel at is the final breathing exercise. I'm really good at it. Final breathing exercise. And so I want to do it with you here because I think it will help demonstrate the way forgiveness flow works. And so what happens at the end is, at the end of the class, you're all in Zen mode. And for the final breathing exercise, you sit back, relax right now. Breathe in deep, and you let it out. And then you do this rapid fire, breathe in, breathe out, and it almost becomes a flow. So that's what I'm going to ask you to do right now. Let me get into, you can have a seat if you want. You get into this yoga, oh my goodness. I'm an old man. I'm in this yoga pose like this. So clap along to the rhythm when I do it, okay? All right, you all going to participate? Can you breathe in with me? And breathe in. And in. And now. Brilliant, you did it. I can't believe you got it. I'm going to get up. I'm like an old man. All right. Here's the thing. You do that. Feeling a little bit lightheaded. You do that over and over again. And one of the things I've noticed with this is you lose sight. You're not consciously thinking, now's the time to breathe in. Now's the time to breathe out. It becomes an automatic flow. It just happens almost without you even noticing it. It becomes automatic. Breathe in, need to breathe out. It's the same with sort of forgiveness. You can't just breathe in and hold it there. It doesn't work. You have to let it out. And the more we do that, the breathe in, the breathe out becomes a flow, becomes natural. It's almost automatic. In fact, it becomes a rhythm that you don't even have to think about. And so it is here. We breathe in the forgiveness God extends to us, and it only becomes natural to breathe it back out. And when we find ourselves in that flow, it allows us to take the hurt and pain and violence done to us. We breathe back life and beauty and grace and love. It starts to becomes natural. I want to close with a story. Jerome Caddell, he once wrote an article for America Magazine called The Good Fight, How Christians Suffer, Die, and Rise with Jesus. And in the article, he recounts an interview that he did at his home with a Christian civil rights activist who was involved in the racial struggles of the 1960s. And Jerome asked this man about the kind of violence he had endured during the civil rights movement. And the young man recounted to him as a college graduate that he had been spit on, beaten up, beaten with clubs and chains, that he had been left as a bloody mess. And then the interviewer, Jerome, said to the man, "Well, you're a pretty big guy. Did you ever fight back?" And this was his response. He said, "Yes, at first I did fight back. I made some of them sorry that they had attacked me. But then I realized that by fighting back, I wasn't getting anywhere. The hatred coming at me in those fists and clubs was bouncing right off me back into the air, and it could just continue to spread like electricity. I decided not to fight back. I would let my body absorb that hatred so that some of it would die in my body and not bounce back into the world. I now see that my job in the midst of evil is to make my body a grave for hate." Oh. That's what this practice is calling us to. To allow ourselves, our bodies, our minds to become a grave for hate and pain and violence, and then we resurrect it as something beautiful. And it's so hard. What do you say to a friend like mine? Ah, that's not an easy path to travel. We make ourselves a grave, our bodies, our minds, a grave for those things that have hurt us and wounded us, and we resurrect them with love and grace and forgiveness. And this morning, my ask is this. May we each commit to being a people of forgiveness in matters that are both big and small. At Nexus, we're walking the Christian path together, and to do that means practicing forgiveness. It's not a one-time thing. For some of us, it will be ongoing years. We might never reach the point, but we travel the path together. And throughout this whole series, I've asked people to join me on stage, and I'm going to ask Marie to do that because I was nervous. I didn't know who to ask that might have a story of unforgiveness. And I mentioned this to Murray, and he bravely said, well, I'll tell a story of the difficulty of forgiveness. So I'm going to hand it over to you, Murray, to tell your story, and then if you could close us in prayer, that'd be great.
I grew up in a family of 9 kids, 5 boys and 4 girls in that order. Although there was always someone fighting and lots of chances to practice forgiveness, that's not the part of our family life I want to talk about this morning. All families have their routines, and one of ours was centered on the Sunday family dinner. Added to our already large family was my grandmother and my grandfather. I loved my grandmother with all my heart. She always lived close by, and I saw her all the time and spent a great deal of time with her. Although odd, I only saw my grandfather on Sundays, as he actually lived in Hamilton and we lived in Toronto. I'll explain that in a minute. I always viewed my grandfather as a grumpy old man. He would always arrive at our house in his big Cadillac and smoking his big cigar, which I hated. This was long before smoking was seen as a health hazard. I'm pretty sure that many of my health issues today can be connected to my inhaling secondhand smoke from my grandfather. My grandfather had a lot of annoying habits, but his most annoying was his emphasis on manners at the table. His big one was no elbows on the table. If you got caught with one of your elbows on the table, he would take his knife and wrap your elbow. From about the time I was 5, I learned to sit as far away from him as possible, and when he pointed at my elbows with his knife, I would look at him like I had no idea what he meant. Our relationship was established early. He also seemed to take over the general discipline of the kids, and not until I was older did I realize how annoying that was to my father. As I grew older, I started to realize that my grandfather only came to Toronto on Sunday to visit my grandmother. He worked there and had a very prosperous business, and so I thought it natural that this is what adults did. I had no other real example, so I just took it as normal. But I finally realized that my grandparents' relationship really wasn't normal when I discovered that my grandfather had run off on my grandmother, my mother, and my aunt with the babysitter. He did, however, continue to support my grandmother and visit once a week. Still kind of weird, eh? Adults do some strange things, I finally decided. So as I got older, I realized that this man I already disliked had seriously offended two of the people I love most in the world, my mother and my grandmother. This made for some subtle and not so subtle behaviors on my part as I got older. To be frank, and that was his name, Frank, I think I actually hated him. There are many more reasons I hated him, but most of them are family secrets, so I won't share them here. But it's important to know that I had a solid case for hating him. To make a long story short, I borrowed some money from my grandmother for the down payment on my first home. Not long after that, my grandmother's dementia caught up with her, and my grandfather decided to step in and collect the debt. Needless to say, I almost enjoyed telling him it was not his business and he had forfeited any right to represent my grandmother a long time ago. You can imagine how that went. He persisted, but I did not relent. He wrote me a number of letters, which I either ignored or replied to with a little too much force. Actually, a lot. His partner, the babysitter, he actually never divorced my grandmother, and when he was 85 and my grandmother finally died, he did marry the babysitter. It doesn't get much weirder, does it? But anyways, this woman called me. I'd never heard her voice before, and to this day, I'd never met her. She called me one day asking me to reconcile with my grandfather, that he really desired that. I did speak with him, but I would not describe our conversation as reconciliation. number of my brothers seemed to have found a way to reconcile with him, but I was unrelenting. He went to his grave without me having forgiven him. I'd always thought that it would never matter to me that I had not forgiven him. But I have to admit that were I to do this over again, I would have worked harder to find a way at forgiveness. I have regret that I am the one who refused to forgive. I want to share with you some of the things I've learned about forgiveness along the way, and many of them come out of this story. And you'll see a lot of overlap between what I've learned and what Brad talked about this morning. Despite what I've confessed here, I'm actually pretty good at most kinds of forgiveness. I have many examples of times both offered and received forgiveness in a genuine fashion, and so I do know both the feeling and the result of true forgiveness. I have to admit that I've had to receive forgiveness more often than offer it. However, saying you're good at forgiveness is missing the point. You're only as good as your toughest test to date. Any behavior can always be improved upon, and until the next toughest test comes along, you can never be sure. I am totally amazed by the examples of forgiveness I have seen or read about. The Coptic Christians in Egypt recently forgave the bombers of the two churches where scores of their brothers and sisters were killed. Or church members in South Carolina who forgave the murderer at their prayer meeting. Or the Mennonites in Pennsylvania who forgave the killer of their little girls. You can imagine after the story I just shared with you this morning that my failure in light of this kind of forgiveness is embarrassing. I believe, although it may not seem so, that forgiveness is as much about the person extending it as receiving it. Personal health is related to our ability to forgive. The negative effect of lack of forgiveness or bitterness is well documented. Because of this incident in my life, I find I just can't resist reading any material that deals with forgiveness. This is probably a good thing for me. While we may be able to accomplish some forgiveness on our own, I think there's a spiritual aspect to forgiveness to such events as Egypt, South Carolina, and Pennsylvania. I think if you discovered that line beyond which you can't extend forgiveness or just don't want to, the only way forward is spiritually. Real forgiveness at the highest levels has a spiritual component to it. Clearly, you can reject this kind of help, and I'm an example of that. Although I didn't forgive my grandfather, this is not a total failure, as the things I learned through this have pushed me to admit my error and look to a future where I hope to do better. The truth in my mind is that I need forgiveness as much as my grandfather did. There's no pointing the finger and saying he started all this, so I'm justified in my behavior. This is how wars start. Forgiveness is God's way of healing this world and stopping the endless circle of bad behavior and revenge. If I said the word justice, a lot of positive things come to mind. Justice is a wonderful thing. Who can be against justice? But even justice has its dark side. We've heard or used the cry, "Justice has not been done. You have robbed me of my rights." This cry has eaten people up. We could easily see the need for justice in situations, and to demand justice can so often lead to that endless downward spiral into bitterness and anger, revenge, and even violence. The only way to end the mass amount of senseless violence and revenge done in the name of justice that dominates our world is forgiveness. And this is probably the line that means the most to me. In a real sense, forgiveness is the ultimate justice. Jesus set the example for forgiveness, and while we were yet sinners, he died for us. It will help all of us to remember that the death and resurrection was completely about forgiveness, something we all need and need to extend. I'd like to finish by repeating a prayer. You don't have to pray along this time, but just bow your heads and focus on these words. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And forgive us our offenses, as we forgive those who offended us. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. Go in peace.